Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the endarkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hello there, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed the light on the endarkened corridors of power, and we shine the light ahead of us to where evolution is leading. Purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right, front and center, to face the music and dance together, to address problems instead of just defending positions. Well, it used to be that the work of heart that I most associated with Christmas was the Frank Capra movie, It's a Wonderful Life. But ever since my friend Shanti Norman recorded John McCutcheon's song Christmas in the Trenches 20 years ago, I've held that that is the extraordinary piece of work that to me best symbolizes the light that can shine in the time of greatest darkness. A bit of background, after World War I began in 1914, the Pope suggested a truce around Christmas time. Well, the generals weren't really interested in that. Their concern was that the enemy trenches were so close that soldiers could actually hear them speaking to their comrades and even smell the food they were cooking. And so it was precisely because of this closeness that peace accidentally broke out on Christmas Eve 1915. So I want to play the song for you, and then we're going to have Marianne Williamson join us for a conversation about how we can leave these entrenched beliefs. But let's first listen to the song, Christmas in the Trenches, written by John McCutcheon and performed by Shanti Norman.
My name is Francis Tolliver. I come from Liverpool. 2 years ago, the war was waiting for me after school. To Belgium and to Flanders, to Germany to hear. I fought for king and country I love dear. 'Twas Christmas in the trenches where the frost so bitter hung. The frozen fields of France were still, no Christmas songs were sung. Our families back in England were toasting us that day. They're brave and glorious lads so far away. I was lying with my messmate on a cold and rocky ground. Across the lines of battle came a most peculiar sound. Says I, now listen up, me boys, each soldier strained to hear. As one young German voice sang out so clear. He's singing bloody well, you know, my partner says to me. Soon one by one, each German voice joined in harmony. The cannons rested silent. The gas cloud rolled no more. As Christmas brought us respite from the war. As soon as they were finished and the reverent pause was spent, God rest ye merry gentlemen, struck up some lads from Kent. The next they sang was Stille Nacht, 'tis Silent Night, says I. And in two tongues one song filled up that sky. There's someone coming towards us, the frontline sentry cried. All eyes were fixed on one young soldier coming from their side. His truce flag like a Christmas star shone on that plain so bright, as he bravely strode unarmed into the night. Then one by one on either side walked into no man's land, with neither gun nor bayonet we met there hand in hand. We shared some secret brandy and wished each other well, and in a flare-lit soccer game we gave them hell. We traded chocolates, cigarettes, and photographs from home. These sons and fathers far away from families of their own. Tom Sanders played his squeeze box and they had a violin. This curious and unlikely band of men. Soon daylight stole upon us, and France was France once more. With sad farewells, we each began to settle back to war. But the question haunted every heart that lived that wondrous night. Whose family have I fixed within my sight? 'Twas Christmas in the trenches, where the frost so bitter hung. The frozen fields of France were warmed as songs of peace were sung. For the walls they kept between us, too exact the work of war. My name is Francis Tolliver, in Liverpool I dwell. Each Christmas comes since World War I, I've learned its lessons well. That the ones who call the shots won't be among the dead and lame, and on each end of the rifle we're the same.
What an amazing song and what an amazing story. It's the only way you can listen to a movie on the radio and be moved by it. This is a true story. That really happened on Christmas time. It happened in a number of different places. And the enemy was rehumanized is probably the best way to look at this. And the trance of separation was broken. The trance of separation. This is really what we're up against here. Of course, we're not yet, and hopefully we'll never be, in a physical shooting war, but America seems to be locked into another version of trench warfare. We seem to be entrenched, thanks to social media and mainstream media, fanning the flames of polarization. We seem to be entrenched in these positions of this side versus that side, and yet the vast majority of people really prefer to find ways of cooperating. And so what we're looking at is how can we break the trance of illusion, the illusion of separation, the trance of separation, and affirm and live and realize that oneness, to coalesce around the virtues and values 90% of us hold in common and activate what we're calling our sane and sacred center. Mm-hmm. And when I thought about this, I figured the person that I wanted to have most have the conversation with is Marianne Williamson, who is a best-selling author, political activist, spiritual thought, new thought leader. You know her. You're well familiar with her work if you're listening to this show. One of her great quotes is, "Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure." So maybe this is the time that we allow that power to emerge. So can Marianne, welcome to our show.
Thank you Steve. I'm honored to be here again. Thank you so much for having me.
Good. Well, you know, every time I hear that song, it's such a moving experience, because it speaks to a fundamental goodness that all humans who aren't sociopaths can feel in their hearts, that we can recognize goodness. You know, we know why we're rooting for the good guy in movies and so on, and yet we seem so easily pulled into these polarities where we are at not just disagreeing, but hating one another. So I know this is a big question, but let's just unravel it the best we can. How do we break this illusion of separation and come together at a time when so many things seem to be pulling us apart?
Well, we know that love is stronger than hate, but we have to be as proactive and convicted behind the display of love as some people are convicted and proactive behind the display of hate. No baby is born to hate. Some people would argue that 0.00001% of, you know, some people might have a criminal DNA, whatever, but that's like such a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of the human race. That of itself is not the problem. But what happens on this earth, of course, is not only that which we know from a metaphysical or spiritual perspective, which is that a thought system based on fear dominates this earth, but along with that, the public policies that too often dominate our societal and collective experience promote the consciousness of fear and promote the consciousness of separation. A political system that does more to advocate for the needs and for the abundance of a very few people at the expense of the majority of people inevitably causes massive amounts of suffering, out of which inevitably emerges societal dysfunction. Large groups of desperate people are a petri dish out of which often grows vulnerability to ideological capture by genuinely psychotic forces. That has happened throughout history, even in the song. This is how Hitler rose. You had such a squashed and oppressed German people after World War I. That a person like Hitler had an easier time saying, "You're really not worse, you're better, the Jews are your problem." This is what happened throughout history. So there are things that we can do to proactively cultivate more enlightened, loving attitudes. That's why after World War II, We didn't make that mistake. We did everything we could to rebuild Germany. We did everything we could to rebuild Japan because we had learned our lesson after World War One. That's why, Steve, the conversation about proactively cultivating peace is gaining ground. Just like decades ago, we began having a conversation about proactively cultivating health. It wasn't just a conversation about allopathic medicine anymore. It's also a conversation about health and wellness. You prevent illness. You don't just fight illness. And we must prevent war and violence and conflict, not just fight it once it arises. That has to do with expanding educational opportunities for children around the world. It has to do with expanding economic opportunities for women around the world. It has to do with reducing violence against women. It has to do with ameliorating unnecessary human suffering wherever we can. Because when those four factors are present, statistically, there is a greater incidence of peace and a decreased incidence of violence. If we add that kind of external remedy, and a consciousness of the importance of those external remedies with meditation, with forgiveness, with spiritual practice, then we're going to have a real formula for radical fundamental change in the direction of a sustainable future for the human race.
You know, this is really important because what you're talking about, you know, your background, obviously, it's in Course in Miracles and it's in our personal development. But this is a fractal conversation that's happening at the individual level, the communal level, the world level, the species-wide level. And so it's not either or, it's both and. We have a very short break coming up. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about what you learned in your campaign that can help us moving forward in these next 4 years. Wiki Politiki, we're talking with Marianne Williamson, back shortly.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on Om Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
These are the sounds of a dinner. A dinner that almost didn't happen. A dinner now served, thanks to people like you. Due to COVID-19, 17 million more Americans may face hunger. Feeding America is helping our neighbors in need. And if you're able, you can too. Donations are being accepted at feedingamerica.org/coronavirus. Brought to you by the Ad Council and Feeding America. 200 food banks strong.
Steve Behrman here. We're back with Marianne Williamson. And, you know, again, I really appreciate two things about your campaign that were very different, that nobody else really picked up on. Number one is the one that you mentioned, looking at, the more global reasons why there is ill health, how to create prevention, and how to not have a system that creates the kind of stress and chemical and emotional and psychological and spiritual stress that our system has created to make people so sick. The other thing is that because you were willing to speak in spiritual, if not religious terms, you ended up creating a bridge. And I remember that you were the only candidate that I can think of running on the Democratic Party slate that actually got interviewed on Fox and perhaps even made a bridge to people who call themselves religious right. Can you tell us more about that, how that happened, and what you learned from it?
Well, I think that the average American understands that we have an inner life as well as an outer life. I mean, this is not something that isn't common sense. And a lot of people like to surround the conversation with false notions of separation of church and state, false notions of religious dogma that they project onto a spiritual conversation. But I don't think the majority of Americans do that. I think we're told all the time, for instance, that the terrorism in the Middle East that we had to deal with for years, we were told about hatred that was preyed upon, the recruitment of young men who were desperate in their lives, had no hope, and how hate groups, terrorist groups in the Middle East recruited such people. We've been told that. We've been told that counterterrorism measures had to do with recognizing how desperate people are vulnerable to ideological capture. Well, that's mm-hmm. no different here in the United States. So when I have talked, or when I did talk during my campaign to audiences about the fact that we have millions and millions of traumatized American children, the fact that when you have so many children who aren't even taught to read by the age of 8, that their chances for high school graduation will be so diminished and their chances of incarceration will be so increased. The average American not only recognizes the immorality of this, that this does not have to happen in the richest country in the world, the average American does not recognize that there's a deep racist underpinning to this. The average American is not stupid. They know how many more black and brown people are in American prison system at much higher rates for the same crime. But also the American voter, in my experience, also understood we're creating serious problems for ourselves in the future. You can't let this much despair accumulate. And that's what we're doing right now, Steve, with what's happening now with 15 million people who might be thrown out of their homes. We had over 30 million people who were hungry even before the pandemic. We had 40 million people who were living with poverty even before the pandemic. Now 8 million people and more have been thrown into poverty since the pandemic began. You have a serious problem with our food banks being overwhelmed. And in the majority of these homes, there are children. And these children are going to grow up into very traumatized, very angry adults. So what we are doing by not taking a more compassionate policy position towards so many people who, through no fault of their own, are now thrown into such desperate conditions by this COVID situation, by our government not choosing to behave with greater mercy and compassion, we are creating, you think we're in trouble now? What we are creating for what will occur 10 years from now and 20 years from now, that we are just going to pass as a baton onto a future generation, is absolutely horrifying. The lack of sociological, psychological, and emotional perspicacity on the part of our government, a government that is like living in, I don't know, the 1970s in its focus and concentration on external political and economic realities, at the expense of, or to the exclusion of, an understanding of the psychological dynamics that they're messing with here, is horrifying and must change if our democracy and even possibly our species is going to thrive over the next 100 years.
What do you think? I mean, it certainly seems that, of course, you know, Donald Trump, we consider him America's balloon karma payment. That kind of brought everything that was under the surface to the surface. And Trudy and I just recently, we watched the 12-hour series of Roots, which we haven't seen in, I guess, 40 years. It was in the 1970s. And in the wake of what happened around Black Lives Matters this year, et cetera, it just needs to be a kind of required viewing to recognize the very, very, very different experience. I mean, yes, we've all had travails and we all have trauma in our DNA. But when you watch this series and look at what it was like, the dehumanization, the brutality, the emotional brutality, the betrayals, and how decent people had to make peace with the system and give into it often. I think it really puts things in perspective now. And, you know, you've been talking about reparations for Black people, you know, for at least 25 years. How does that become more possible now? Now that we've been through this, it looks like we're coming to the end of this the Trump trauma. Does this become more possible now?
Well, I think that by refusing to elect President Trump for a second term, we have caused a break in the action. But that doesn't mean that we're home free. Mm-hmm. It is a big deal that we no longer have the President of the United States stoking the hatred and legitimizing the insanity and the sociopathology of white supremacist hate groups and so forth. Mm-hmm. That is certainly a very good thing. But that does not mean that we're out of the woods. And what we absolutely must do is start proactively articulating and acting on a more compelling version, a more compelling vision for America's future. Now, when you talk about a conversation around reparations, for me, because I come from the personal growth, spiritual transformation field, I'm aware that there are certain principles of consciousness. And one of those principles of consciousness is that you can't move forward in life until you've cleaned up the past. That's simply the way life is. And it's written into the tenets of all the great religious and spiritual systems of the world, that you must atone, that you must make amends, that you have to clean up what happened before you are really free to go forward. And I realize that a nation is just a collection of people. So when you take a serious look at America's racial past, if you look the way, as you said, movies like Roots makes clear, that the first slave ships were brought over in 1619, that slavery lasted for almost 250 years, that it was followed by another 100 years of domestic terrorism in the form of segregation, that the Civil Rights Act dismantled segregation, that the Voting Rights Act created universal access to the polls, that, however, and I think in large part due to the death of Martin Luther King Jr., there was one big piece in all this that we never got around to. And after Martin Luther King died in 1968 and Richard Nixon was elected president, the policy position that he stood on related to race in America was what was called by his domestic advisor, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, benign neglect. Mm-hmm. And what that meant was that the economic gap created by slavery maintained segregation, that even though segregation was dismantled, the effect of the Black Code laws that guaranteed subpar economic and political and social opportunity for Black people continued and was never seriously interrupted or abated, to the point today where we have systemic ways in which Black people can get the same education, they can achieve the same touches on their resume, and yet will routinely make less money and have less opportunity to get ahead. This will have to be addressed in order for white America as well as Black America to have the future that we all want for our children and for our grandchildren. Now, one of the things I found fascinating when I was doing the research was that, the idea of reparations is nothing new. And by the end of the 20th century, monetary reparations, economic restitution for harm done against the people by another people, was not considered some fringe idea. Germany has paid $89 billion to Jewish organizations in reparations for the Holocaust. Now, that doesn't mean the Holocaust didn't happen, but those reparations have gone far towards establishing not just economic, but emotional and psychological reconciliation between Germany and the Jews of Europe. The full-on mea culpa, which included not just the apology, but it included the amends. the apology, the recognition of white privilege, everybody purifying their hearts, coming to understand, all that's important, but it's not enough. Because if you owe me $1,000, as much as I would like I appreciate your apology, I also want the money back. And that's why we have to now move into the conversation of serious amends. And serious amends in this case would mean economic restitution in the form of reparations.
Well, it certainly makes sense. Having watched that series, I really, really got, you know, again, people say, well, we have White Lives Matters too, but it's really important. And I think that we don't have the historical context in this country. History isn't taught. I don't know what's happening in schools, but a lot of people just simply are focused on current events. I think that's probably why some of these QAnon memes and those kinds of things can take hold, because people don't have the historical perspective, you know, to recognize that a lot of that's recycled protocols of the Elders of Zion material, from the anti-Semitic, the 20th, early part of the 20th century. So I think that there has to be something that that connects the two sides. And I keep calling it a sane and sacred center, because I see, and I know you do too, that when there is the absence of this agreed upon sense of something that is bigger than religion and non-religion, but really resonates, as you suggested earlier, with what everybody knows in their hearts, pretty much. We've defaulted into these two separate realities. And even a year ago, when you were wrapping up your presidential campaign, I don't think it was as clear that we were in these two separate realities. So in this past year, I know you have probably been, healing from your very, very public presidential campaign and so on. What has this year been like for you, and what kinds of, what thoughts have come to you, particularly in the wake of what's happened in this very unpredictable year?
Well, I'm going through what everybody's going through, and in many cases, I'm just reminded how fortunate I am. When you think of how many people are losing their homes, right, when you think of how many people are losing their health insurance, when you think of how many people don't know how they're going to feed their kids, what I've been going through doesn't really seem to me like a big deal. I did have to heal on a personal level because a political campaign, and I think this was particularly true of mine, was brutal. And I appreciated the conversation that you and I had about it when you and I spoke last time on your show. But it was almost a year ago. And with everything that the country is going through, I think all of us owe it not only to ourselves, but to our country and to the future, not to dwell more than is necessary on our personal dramas. Yes, it was a healing process, and I had to look within myself for the things, the demons that I had to be most wary of. I had to be wary of the demon of self-pity. I had to be wary of the demon of victimization. I had to be wary of the demon of bitterness. I had to be wary of the demon of lack of self-awareness. I had to do my inner work, no different than anyone else. I've known for years that if I practice what I preach, my life works pretty well. But now, particularly the fact that it's almost a year, I feel that I've been given the opportunity to think long and hard about what I went through, but I don't want to live in the past. I want the past to be not impinging on my present so that I can have miracles in the future. None of us can afford to make this moment in history about ourselves. It's about all of us. The consciousness which is going to get us through all this is not a consciousness of me, it's a consciousness of we. And I don't say that as though my personal work isn't important. I say it as though my personal work isn't the issue in a larger sense. And there are a lot of hours in the day. Now we have to deal with the fact that if our new president does not, and this is what I talked about in my campaign, but it is far more true now even than it was then. I said we needed a massive infusion of economic hope and opportunity into the life of the average American. And I feel that now in a way that is even more true. We are living in revolutionary times, Steve. There is a, you know, if there's an earthquake about to happen, we don't yet have the technological capacity to warn of a physical earthquake. But we do have the capacity, if our eyes are open and we have any kind of awareness, we do have the capacity to warn and to predict a political earthquake. And there is a political earthquake coming very quickly. We are living with such underground rumblings. I don't think you or I can even begin to appreciate the massive amount of rage, the massive amount of fury, the massive amount of desperation that people are feeling today because of the chintzy $600 one-time payment and $300 a week extension on unemployment benefits that came with that COVID bill yesterday, while hundreds of billions of dollars still went to pay the Pentagon. We will either have a revolution of love and justice, or we are going to have a revolution of violence and pain. And I agree with everything you say. We need to get to it. We need to get to it now. As we begin by doing exactly what you're doing, articulating these solutions, and then having serious conversations about how to bring those solutions into manifestation, both in terms of our own private spiritual practice and purification, and also in terms of the politics that we support.
Good. Well, we're going to take a very short break. We'll be back with Marianne Williamson shortly after this. This is Steve Behrman on Wiki Politiki.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
911, what is your emergency?
My kid shot himself.
All right, where's the wounds?
911, what's your emergency?
Please help. My son shot his brother.
911, what is your emergency?
Okay. 911, please state your emergency.
Every day, 8 kids and teens are unintentionally killed or injured by loaded and unlocked guns.
It wasn't locked.
Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and End Family Fire.
And then this is really a proactive thing that the statistics I'm seeing is that more than three quarters of the people in this country would prefer to find ways to collaborate and cooperate. And to me, I'm seeing that this is really an opening. We have the we have tremendous rage, as you said. It's not even measurable in many different communities. And the fact that we really can't see one another face-to-face except on Zoom makes it even more difficult to rehumanize the other. In going forward over this next period of time, and I like to look at it as the next 4 years, because I think that this is really a transitional administration, and if we're fortunate, the transition is toward the American people accepting their legacy of the Declaration of Independence and preamble to the Constitution, and become the wise citizens that that is our potential. In this period of time, how do we bridge the gap and actually spark this this conversation or uprising or whatever you want to call it that will shift our focus from the hate and dislike of one another, the harm the harming revolution, to the revolution of love and connection?
We need a politics of conscience. You know, there was a time in my lifetime when the high-minded principles of the Democratic Party and the high-minded principles of the Republican Party were the basis for political dialogue, high-minded conservative and high-minded liberal principles. And General Eisenhower, President Eisenhower said, the American mind at its best is both liberal and conservative. But the Republican Party has been taken over hook, line, and sinker, particularly since the it began with the Reagan Revolution, but particularly since the Trump phenomenon.
I want to make a correction. You meant hook, line, and stinker.
Yeah, no kidding. Okay. By a consciousness which is so corporatist, which means that it advocates for short-term profits for huge multinational corporate entities at the expense of the well-being of the people and the planet. And that is mainly, primarily, because of the money that so unduly influences our politics today, that too often our leaders are at the behest of a system of legalized bribery. They are, because of the money in politics, doing more to advocate for their donors than for their constituents. Now, the other party is not without its collusion with that mentality. The other party tries to have it both ways, and that's why there's such a split within the Democratic Party. Bill Clinton started something called the Democratic Leadership Council, and his point was we can play it both ways. We can play with the big boys in business, too. And what that did was to create what's called the corporate Democrats. So the corporate Democrats have such power within the Democratic Party that they're saying, yeah, people are hurting and we don't want them to hurt and we want to make people's lives not miserable. But they won't challenge the underlying forces that make all that suffering inevitable because they are at the behest of those corporate donors as well. So our whole political system has become a kingdom of whoredom whereby insurance companies, big pharmaceutical companies, big oil, defense manufacturers, big ag oil companies, chemical companies, food companies, gun manufacturers are like a new aristocracy in this country. So Republicans need to work to get the soul of the Republican Party back. Democrats need to work to get the soul of the Democratic Party back. I don't know if it's going to work for either because so many people are now becoming independent. And many progressives don't know if they're going to be able to stay locked in the basement of the Democratic Party, if they're going to break out and have another political party. We've got to break the chokehold that this unholy alliance between the Democratic and the Republican parties have placed on the neck of America. I can tell you that much.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And my joke about it, and of course, a lot of jokes are not funny these days because it's way too serious, is that the Republicans have sold their soul to the devil. The Democrats have just rented there. So, you know, they're not quite onto that program. But because of the system that you just mentioned, it forces people to play by those rules.
I want to say something to you about you and about being a comedian that I was thinking about when your introduction was happening today.
Yeah.
Look how many comedians in America have become the most serious political commentators. Look at Jon Stewart, Al Franken, Trevor Noah, Jimmy Dore, and yourself. I think it's very, very interesting that often it is not the political class having the most intelligent political conversation because they're the ones who drove us into this ditch. The
right.
People whose careers have been entrenched within the mindset that drove us into this ditch, to the idea that only they should be considered even entitled to have the conversation, much less any kind of monopoly on truth regarding how we get out of the ditch, is so ridiculous. But I think it's so interesting, and I think of you in this category, because I remember when we talked last time on your podcast, and I'm talking, my God, I had no idea it was going to be such a serious conversation. So I would urge you, Steve, the fact that you don't hide behind the funny language either, because it's too late a moment in that. I find you a very serious and very wise political commentator. So I'm one person in your audience who, as much as I enjoy all the funny stuff, really welcome the seriousness with which you approach political issues.
I appreciate that. And of course, as you recognize, I mean, behind every comedian, there's a serious person.
Absolutely.
I can't even imagine what my life would have been like without humor, because if you're able to see these contradictions, we call it irony deficiency that most people suffer from, not really being willing to look at these contradictions. And, you know, it's these toxic contradictions that we're seeing, you know, the idea of, you know, I'm pro-life, but when the unborn fetus becomes a born feed us, we don't want to feed them. Again, we start looking at these contradictions, or people who on the progressive side believe in tolerance, but they will not tolerate fundamentalist Christians and so on. So I think humor is a tool. It's kind of like a people tenderizer, because what it does is it allows us to. I think one of my favorite quotes is from The Little Prince, and I'm going to kill the quote a little bit, but it's something like, love is not looking one another in the eye. Love is looking outward together in the same direction. And what humor does is it takes us out of ourselves. You necessarily have to have your attention out there in order to see the joke. If you're so caught up in yourself, you have no sense of humor, because you're not willing to look at any contrast. A sense of humor and jokes can bust the trends of it's either this or that, which we're stuck in, and often points us toward a third way, a new way of looking at things. And what you're saying, and you're saying that the entire show, is that we need desperately this new way of looking at things. And I think that that's really what I'm looking to cultivate. I'm happy that I can come up with phrases like the Great Uprising, the Saint Sacred Center, because they help capture the imagination of people. But my background is in political science. That's been my love since I was a kid. And I have an appreciation of what is needed right now in terms of the ways that people need to communicate with one another and develop their our collective intelligence. And I'll say one more thing about me, and we'll get back to you. One of my jobs back in the day, I taught auto workers at Wayne State University. I taught at UAW locals. I taught auto workers ethnic studies and labor history. And I loved that job. I loved that job because these were people who were non-pretentious. And they would say to me, wow, you know, you're the first professor we've ever had that's talked sense to us. And I think that part of that disenfranchisement, I can talk to anybody and I do. The disenfranchisement that people feel in the so-called quote-unquote flyover country is the disrespect coming from the intellectual elites that dismiss their experience and what they've gone through and what they know and their mundane workaday world that's not as glamorous as what you or I do. And I think that there needs to be a huge reintroduction of respectful conversation and listening. Not as a patronizing thing of, you know, oh, we need to listen to you people and all that. It's much more a curiosity and a desire to rehumanize.
Yeah, well, it's also a respect for the fact that nobody has a monopoly on the truth, and that nobody's experience is inherently more meaningful than anybody else's. Did you just say Wayne State, as in Detroit, Michigan?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, my Trudy is from Detroit, and I lived in Ann Arbor for about 8 years. 10 years, I moved to Michigan so that my girlfriend at the time could work at Upland Hill School, one of the most amazing schools I've ever encountered. And so, yeah, I've got a big history in Michigan, and
yeah,
my job
I do
was at Wednesday.
Yeah, I do too. I raised my daughter there. And like you, you can't live in or near Detroit and not learn about the deeper roots of the American experience that they don't necessarily understand in, you know, the cocktail party circuit of Los Angeles or New York or Washington, D.C.
Yeah, and what
that
I found,
it's
real. It was real, and I had no problem with that. I liked that. And, you know, to me, a pivotal moment in the 2016 campaign was at the debate when Donald Trump pointed to Hillary Clinton and said, "This is how a politician talks." And I think part of understanding the appeal of Donald Trump is that people consider him plain-spoken, direct, et cetera, and not standing behind these formalities that often put a nice face on the kinds of things that have been going on in this country for generations through the Clinton administration, through the Obama administration.
And through the Bush administration, so let's not make it like
of
this
course.
Is a Bush
no, we're not going to let. No, we're not going to let him off the hook whatsoever.
This is ridiculous. The whole thing started with Reagan. I mean, the template was created by the Reagan years. The problem is not that the Democrats created it, but that the Democrats didn't interrupt it enough. Although Jimmy Carter, I think, certainly did. So the issue is where we are now.
Yes.
And I think where we are now has less to do with whether it's Democrats or Republicans and more to do with our realizing that while it seems like they are so divided, the bigger problem is not where they are so different. The bigger problem is in the areas where they are too much the same. When it comes, for instance, to deference to the military-industrial complex, they're not all that different. When it comes to deference to insurance companies and big pharmaceutical companies, they're not all that different. When it comes to environment, climate change, they're very, very different. There are issues where they are very, very different, and there are issues where they're different enough that definitely the Democrats are the ones much, infinitely more than the Republicans that are holding to the values that America even purports to embrace. But neither of them are going fast enough for what's needed right now to make the fundamental turnaround that we need to make before the ship hits the iceberg. Because we are dangerously close.
Yeah.
We are dangerously close. And that's I'm sorry, go on.
No, go ahead, because I want you to complete that thought. I had a reflection on it.
Well, I think that this COVID bill yesterday, tomorrow night, I'm going to be interviewing Dylan Radigan on my platforms, on my Twitter and Facebook page.
Good.
I'll be interviewing him tomorrow night at 8 p.m. East Coast time. My podcast this week is with the economist Stephanie Kelton about modern monetary theory and building the people's economy. Her book, The Deficit Myth, that's out right now. And today on Twitter, I was talking about the fact that I think we need to stop enabling Nancy Pelosi, who I have a lot of respect for her past, but I don't believe we have 2 years for the Democrats to convince the American people that they really offer a genuinely different and more compelling vision. I think they have about 100 days to do it. And when I hear anything coming from the incoming administration, that they will be taking an incremental and gradual approach rather than an FDR-like massive, fundamental, quick infusion of economic opportunity, much along the lines of what FDR did with the New Deal, it concerns me. And I think that in order for that change to occur, the Democratic leadership must have a new face. The same old will not do. And I seriously hope and would seriously support Nancy Pelosi resigning, not running again, so that we can have a new face on a Democratic leadership in the House of Representatives. And if she does not step down and say she won't be running, I hope very much that members of the House of Representatives, there will be some serious competition so that new faces, new people, and new policies can be presented to the American people as a real alternative to the Trump way. Otherwise, all that the Democratic Party is going to be doing is saying, just like they used to say, well, we're not Trump. they will be offering, well, we're not McConnell, and that will not be enough. And if it's not enough, then the House of Representatives could go to the Republicans in 2022. God forbid we could have a Trump redux, even if it's not Trump himself, in 2024. And if that were to happen, I seriously, seriously fear for our democracy.
Well, yes, of course, Trump is, with all, it's because of his detriments that he hasn't succeeded further. But he has, there's a constituency that's ready for that idea. Miriam, this has been really very edifying. And I think that you're absolutely right. There needs to be some kind of fundamental, from the grassroots up, change that impacts that Democratic Party leadership. The leadership needs to come from us. We need to get not behind the Democratic Party, but in front of them. And thank you for helping us be in front of this conversation and
well,
the leadership that you've provided. Okay?
Thank you so much. Thank you.
And thank you for being on our show. This is Steve Behrman on WikiPolitiki. We'll be with you again next week. Thank you, Marianne Williamson.
Thank you, Steve. Bye.